Well, I do thank you for this opportunity to speak to you again. By way of introduction, I wasn't expecting this to be the last paper in our conference, and I fully expected that Dr. Samuel's paper would tie things together and be more hortatory and a little more uplifting. And as the new perspective, which is the topic I'm speaking on, is unmitigated bad news, then without having had the time to rewrite my paper, it doesn't end on that sort of note, but I hope you'll understand that situation. So the title of my paper, which was given me, was Justification by Faith and Contemporary Evangelicalism, Old Perspectives and New. Nearly 30 years ago, InterVarsity Press, a mainstream evangelical publisher, produced its new dictionary of theology. Its entries on righteousness and justification, written by N.T. Wright, declared, "Righteousness plays a central role in Paul's debate with those who sought to keep the covenant community within the bounds of physical Judaism. They, Paul says, are seeking to establish a righteousness of their own, i.e., a covenant membership for Jews alone." I think Wright's begging the question a little there. "The central biblical discussions of righteousness thus principally concern membership in the covenant. Justification is a matter of covenant membership. Justification establishes the church as a new entity, transcending racial and social barriers. Paul's polemic against works of the law is not directed against those who attempted to earn covenant membership, but against those who sought to demonstrate their membership. The idea that righteousness principally concerns covenant membership, so justification is a matter of ecclesiology, is classic New Perspective teaching. Allow me to exhibit a few more thoroughbreds from this stable so that we know what we're about. Justification is the doctrine which insists that all who share faith in Christ belong at the same table, no matter what their racial differences. Paul's gospel of justification by faith is clearly aimed at Jewish assumption of privileged status before God. What Paul means by justification is, how can you tell who is a member of the covenant family? Such ideas became apparent through the work of Swedish scholar Krista Stendahl in the 1960s and began to get traction in the 1970s through the work of American scholar E.P. Sanders and British scholars N.T. Wright and James Dunn. Stendahl and Wright later became bishops of Stockholm and Durham, respectively. Now, I have a few of their books here, just so you might see. This is the famous book by E.P. Sanders, Paul and Palestinian Judaism, that came out in 1977. Here is James Dunn's collection of essays entitled The New Perspective on Paul. And N.T. Wright, well, I need a bookcase to show his books. He has written so much, but fortunately, in 2013, he sort of condensed it all and summarised all his writings into this two-volume work called Paul and the Faithfulness of God. Actually, it's not all condensed in there because there was another section he took out and published in the following years a separate book. But the benefit of this is that it shows Wright, it shows his mature work. It's the product of 40 years of his work, really. So when I cite Wright, I'll be citing mostly from this book rather than any of his old writings, so it's as fair upon him as it can possibly be. New Perspective teachings found their way into materials used by divinity students during the 1980s, and in 1997, Wright pitched a book at a popular level, provocatively entitled What St. Paul Really Said, which infused the teachings into the wider church. So pervasive did the new perspective view become that as early as 2001, New Testament scholar D.A. Carson, who doesn't share this view, incidentally, conceded that it is not going beyond the evidence to say that the new perspective is the reigning paradigm. 15 years later, there are those operating beyond the new perspective, such as Douglas Campbell, who teaches that justification by faith, what he calls justification theory, was a doctrine of Paul's opponents, and that Paul's epistle to the Romans was his rhetorical counterblast against teachers of the doctrine who managed to reach Rome before he did. Incredible though this may seem, this view is defended in his enormous 1,248-page book, The Deliverance of God, published in 2013, the title being his take on the righteousness of God in Romans 1:17. And he says, Paul's interpretation has been captured by Arian foundationalism. That's what he describes as the Reformed view, Arian foundationalism, of the Western Ordo in its vulgar Protestant variation of sola fide. There is a parallel movement traceable to the teaching of Norman Shepherd, who was dismissed from Westminster Theological Seminary in the early 1980s in relation to his teaching that works were an instrument of justification. His book, The Call of Grace, published in 2000, combined faith and works into justification by faithfulness. Some of his followers and former students held a conference at Auburn Avenue Presbyterian Church in 2002 and founded the Federal Vision Movement, which has had devastating repercussions within Presbyterian denominations in the USA ever since. Though Federal Vision shares many of the presuppositions and ideas of the new perspective, and N.T. Wright has addressed their conference, the movements are separate, and I shall be focusing the remainder of this paper on the new perspective. My aim is to show how the new perspective came about and describe some of the teachings of its major proponents, examine its presuppositions, and demonstrate that it is a dangerous concatenation of non sequiturs based on caricatures and dubious scholarship. New perspective views on justification are part of the wider new perspective on Paul, which is itself reliant on a new perspective on Judaism. The new perspective on Paul evaluates Paul within the context of this new perspective on Judaism. There is no attempt to compare scripture with scripture, to establish a systematic or biblical view of justification. Having excluded as post-Pauline the epistles in which the Gentile problem is not found, on the presupposition that Paul was principally concerned about that question, the new perspective draws the conclusion from the remaining epistles that justification must be a polemical doctrine of ecclesiology addressing the Gentile problem. Justification does appear in the excluded epistles, of course, and Saunders and Dunn acknowledge that verses within them would undermine the new perspective if they were included. N.T. Wright is less keen to set aside some of the epistles in which those verses are found, so his methodology for dealing with those troublesome verses in his 1,700-page doorstopper, Paul and the Faithfulness of God, is to ignore them completely. For a confessional Protestant, the new perspective is impossible, because it denies the confessional position on justification, and it operates on premises and with a hermeneutic opposed to the Protestant confessions. Protestant confessions openly set out their presuppositions, but only by examining the writings of new perspective advocates can we distill out the premises upon which they are operating. Just to say as an aside here, we could spend a lot of time doing exegesis, which I'm not going to be doing. And one of the reasons for that is because if you don't have the same presuppositions, if you don't hold the same scriptures, if you don't have the same methodology, then you can do exegesis and trade various things as much as you want, but it just goes simply past their heads. So my paper and my advice to you is to look at their presuppositions, because if those can be weakened or destroyed, then the whole new perspective collapses. The first three are common higher critical presuppositions. We won't spend any time destroying those. These are old ideas. Paul did not write many of the letters ascribed to him, and those epistles cannot be used as evidence. That's the first one. The second is, we have no record of Paul's public addresses. No, according to Wright, we don't. The accounts in Acts, according to N.T. Wright, I'm quoting him directly, were, quote, put into his mouth by the author of Acts, just as Shakespeare put words into the mouth of Julius Caesar. The Gospels and Acts are historically unreliable, partisan, and to a greater or lesser extent, anti-Jewish. Wright says, nothing massive will rest on Acts. It cannot be used naively as it stands as a historical source. And the Gospels, he says, are, quote, hard to use because of the multiple questions that have been raised about their historical value, especially in the light of the writer's obvious agendas. But what about Wright's agenda? He imposes upon Scripture his own incredible narrative, cobbled together from extra-biblical sources, and says, quote, as with all major Pauline topics, we face the choice of either working through all the relevant passages and then drawing conclusions, well, that would seem the most sensible way, or setting out a working hypothesis and then showing how the key passages reflect it. I choose the latter course. This then is the way of eisegesis. No passage is key if it does not affirm the hypothesis, and others can be either ignored or tortured until they confess. This is even noticed by James Dunn, who says, quote, it would appear as though what does not belong to Wright's reading of Paul does not belong to Paul's theology, unquote. The next two premises, and we will spend some time on these, the next two premises rely on E.P. Sanders, and that is that New Testament materials may not be used to establish anything concerning the beliefs and practices of Judaism. And secondly, Judaism in the first century was a religion of grace with no element of works righteousness. The next four premises were developed especially by Stendhal, Dunn and Wright. They are potent for undermining confidence in Protestant exegesis by representing the reformers' views as errors due to cultural factors. It provides the reformers with legitimate excuses and sends them packing. The first is that the ideas of personal sin, salvation, and introspection are largely modern concepts foreign to the ancient mind. Secondly, Martin Luther experienced a dramatic conversion from pursuing works righteousness to an unexampled understanding of justification by faith. And he assumed Paul had a similar conversion experience. Thirdly, the reformers invented the doctrine of justification by faith alone by interpreting the New Testament anachronistically according to their own experience and worldview. And fourthly, the reformers reacted against Pelagianism in the Roman Catholic Church and wrongly assumed that Paul was reacting to a similar problem of proto-Pelagianism in Judaism. Now, whoever has bought into the new perspective without signing up to all those premises has been sold a pup. What is more, much of what his advocates say about the reformers, historical theology, Romanism, and Judaism is false. Throughout this paper, in order to understand Judaism on its own terms, I will be citing only Jewish experts who practice that religion rather than relying on Sanders. The irony is that New Perspective proponents take as presuppositions that the reformers misinterpreted Paul by reading him through a 16th century mindset, yet fail to recognise that it is they who have constructed and imposed this very narrative on them from their own very contemporary worldviews. The great sin in modern society is not the private sin of trusting in oneself, because of which the Pharisee did not go down to his house justified, but the social sins of racism, nationalism, sexism, homophobia, and such like. So there is an interest to read and press the doctrines of the faith into the service of the equality agenda and social action. All the self-help books today espouse believing in oneself and an I'm okay, you're okay attitude. So it is little wonder that justification by faith, which repudiates self-reliance, will be under pressure to be rebranded as a doctrine of cultural criticism for the elimination of difference. But don't take my word for it. Daniel Boyarin, a rabbinical Jew and professor of Talmudic culture at the University of California in Berkeley, and visiting professor of Talmud at the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, entered the New Perspective fold, portraying Paul as a cultural critic in his book, A Radical Jew, and stating that his aim thereby was, quote, to establish that the social gospel was central to Paul's ministry, i.e., that the eradication of human difference and hierarchy was its central theme. Boyarin could thus make common cause with the New Perspective's aims to rebrand justification by faith as a tool for social and political action, as James Dunn outlines. Quote, this discovery of the social dimensions of justification by faith indicates that social concerns lie at the heart of this so characteristic and fundamental Christian and Protestant doctrine. Which is also to say that the obligation to such social action and political action lies at the heart of our faith. Failure to recognise this major dimension of Paul's doctrine of justification by faith may have ignored or excluded a vital factor in combating the nationalism and racialism which has so diminished Christianity. With such a restatement, the doctrine of justification by faith could emerge once again in its full power as a means of salvation for both individual and community. In the late 1970s, Sanders, Dunn, and Wright were in the position of having discarded the Protestant doctrine of justification before they had discovered their social substitute. Developing a substitute necessitated corresponding restatements of faith, righteousness, works, the gospel, election, atonement, and salvation in order to give some coherence. I shall be focusing on justification, but as an example of these wider implications, Dunn states that, quote, Paul understood the significance of the cross and its curse primarily in terms of its significance for the Gentile question. The curse which was removed by Christ's death was the curse of a wrong understanding of the law. So Christ went to the cross to put right a misunderstanding. Wright similarly teaches, and I'm not quoting him directly because it's too long, but I'm paraphrasing what he says in his book. Wright similarly teaches that Christ's death was to solve the Gentile problem and was only necessary because Israel messed up, something none of the apostles understood until Paul developed his theology and it lay dormant until Wright discovered it again 2,000 years later. Right. Just looking at the exegetical results of applying those presuppositions, bringing these presuppositions to bear on Scripture, the new perspective generates the following doctrines in relation to justification. Firstly, the righteousness of God revealed in the gospel is his own faithfulness. Secondly, that Christ obtained righteousness, or that righteousness can be imputed, are mere fictions. Thirdly, the gospel and justification by faith are not primarily to do with the salvation of individuals. Fourthly, justification is a doctrine of ecclesiology, not soteriology. Faith is now the badge of membership of the covenant community, superseding works of the law, which was the badge valid for Jews. Faith is the ground rather than the instrument of justification, and connotes faithfulness or faithful obedience. So justification is, to cite Wright, as we heard last night, quote, on the basis of the whole life lived. Paul was a cultural critic, not concerned primarily with individual sin, forgiveness and salvation, but in communal and social concerns to do with Jewish and Gentile relations. Paul's polemics against justification by works were directed against Jewish displays of separateness, exclusivity, xenophobia, nationalism and racism. Justification by faith was a polemical doctrine used by Paul to eliminate social differences, and it remains a powerful tool for advancing the social gospel. James Dunn, followed by Wright, says that Galatians chapter 2, verses 15 and 16 is, quote, the most obvious place to start any attempt to take a fresh look at Paul from our new perspective. And we read that passage earlier. Here they can go straight for the jugular on the doctrine of justification. So we need look no further afield. Just those two verses, if I read them again. We who are Jews by nature and not sinners of the Gentiles, knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the law, but by the faith of Jesus Christ, even we have believed in Jesus Christ, that we might be justified by the faith of Christ, and not by the works of the law. For by the works of the law shall no flesh be justified. Commenting on this, Wright says, quote, when Paul starts talking about how one is justified in chapter 2, verses 15 and 16, the exegete has a choice. Either we say he has just changed the subject, or we conclude that his talk about justification is not about how I get saved, but about whether uncircumcised Gentiles should eat at the same table with Jewish believers. Being declared righteous and being welcomed at the same table seem to be directly correlated. This is at the heart of the new perspective. Well, correlation, of course, has no explanatory power. And notice how Wright sets up his straw man and false dichotomy. Was the narrative about dining arrangements or salvation? Well, the eating arrangements were just the latest symptom of a wrong view of justification. The issue mentioned earlier in chapter 2 was about circumcision. We read it earlier. The wrong teaching would appear to be adding works to faith for justification, making Jewish works a necessary condition for justification. And that's a point that we will return to again and again, whether adding works and doing works is a condition for justification. But we note that it was for the truth of the gospel that Paul withstood the Judaizing circumcises in chapter 2, verse 5. And it was for the truth of the gospel that he withstood Peter for compelling Gentiles to Judaize in verse 14. And it was for the truth of the gospel that he was writing to the Galatians, chapter 1, verses 6 to 12. Surely the truth of the gospel is to do with salvation. But remembering their premises, when new perspective proponents see the association between justification and the truth of the gospel, they are presuppositionally blinded to the gospel's association with individual salvation. Accordingly, they think justification must be a matter of fellowship. Riot is at pains to tell us that the word salvation nowhere appears in Galatians, and that the gospel is a Christus Victor proclamation that the God of Israel is putting the world right by putting his spiritual enemies to flight and casting down the heathen deities, in which scheme of things the individual salvation of mere mortals plays a rather lowly bit part. Applying another presupposition, they argue that as Sanders showed that Judaism was a religion of grace, which I have to say is a rather trite, simplistic misunderstanding of Sanders, it could not have taught that righteousness could be acquired through performing the requirements of Torah. So such an idea of justification by the works of the law cannot be the foil for Paul's doctrine of justification by faith. The question, of course, is, did Sanders actually teach that? This is now an urban myth. So if anybody would like to check this at some time afterwards, let me just tell you what he says on page 506. He says, when he, that's Paul, denies that righteousness can come by the law, he cannot be denying that Jewish righteousness comes by the law, for that righteousness is defined as being Torah obedience, as Paul knows perfectly well. So you see here that the New Perspective takes something that they haven't really read Sanders properly, and it's a denial of what Sanders says. In fact, what happens after 1977 is Sanders didn't really realise the New Perspective was going to come into existence. He'd written this book. Suddenly there was a load of people saying this is the best book ever, and the New Perspective was developed, and Sanders then pitched in with that. But you have to go back and read what he actually said and see whether what he says supports the New Perspective. It doesn't. But he says that he's rather silent about that afterwards. So, if it's not a foil for justification by faith, if performing works, the requirements of Torah and justification by works of law are not a foil for Paul's doctrine, the New Perspective of proponents must therefore attach some other meaning to works of the law. And in doing so, they end up redefining faith, putting faith and works into the same category as badges or boundary markers. Jews perform works of Torah to identify themselves as Jews, and Christians exercise Christian faith to identify themselves as Christians. But since both Jews and Gentiles can be Christians, the inclusive badge of faith trumps the exclusive badge of Jewish works. Justification is thus a matter of public displays of religion. In their own words, quote, works of the law are the badges that mark out Jews as God's people. Faith is now the only appropriate badge of membership within God's true renewed people. Faith becomes the boundary marker, trumping all other contenders, particularly the traditions of table fellowship. As an aside, James Dunn is usually credited with redefining the works of the law as boundary markers or badges. However, this idea turns up in a footnote by Karl Barth decades earlier. Going back to the presupposition that Judaism that leads to this, we take issue with the premise that grace automatically excludes meritorious works. Such is the standard framework of a covenant of works. It is not technically inconsistent for a religion to include works unto salvation. Well, it's unbiblical, but it's not technically inconsistent. Yet consider itself a religion of grace. Such is Judaism, as we shall see. Such also is Romanism, as we have seen. Jews and Romanists and Muslims come to that, teach that works need not be intrinsically meritorious. Merit attaches to works by the sheer grace and pleasure of God. Luther correctly notes that such a doctrine of salvation is, quote, common to all heathen papists, the Jews, the Mohammedans, and the sectaries. Secondly, we must question what relevance Judaism has to this matter. Paul distances himself from his time past in the Jews' religion, as we read earlier, and the men came from James, not from the Jewish authorities. Beliefs in mainstream Judaism can have no bearing on whether a wrong doctrine of justification should spring up within the church or be imported from ideas that certainly existed in the first century Judaism, as witnessed by extant Jewish literature. Well, think about it. The new perspective is saying that works righteousness couldn't spring up in the church because it wasn't in Judaism. So isn't the new perspective argument here as daft as to assert that Lutherans could not have opposed their Bishop Osiander's views on justification because his views were not representative of Roman Catholicism? Thirdly, since it is a new perspective premise that New Testament materials cannot be used to establish anything about Judaism, why should Jewish materials have any bearing on the New Testament, in particular a dispute within the Christian church? Fourthly, if we allow reference to Judaism, we must mention that the Jews assert, as we shall demonstrate, that keeping the law is a necessary, though not sufficient, condition for justification. And therefore, it is entirely plausible that Paul was opposing such a doctrine infecting the church by Judaizers. Fifthly, we believe from the testimony of Acts 15, verse 1, that certain men which came down from Judea taught the brethren and said, "Except ye be circumcised after the manner of Moses, ye cannot be saved." And so they made works a necessary condition for salvation, which Paul describes in Galatians, as we read, as subverting the truth of the gospel. Sixthly, it appears that justification is all the more likely related to salvation when we look at Paul's gospel preaching when he addressed Jews in the synagogue at Antioch in Pisidia, Acts chapter 13, verses 38 and 39. "Through this man is preached unto you the forgiveness of sins, and by him all that believe are justified from all things from which ye could not be justified by the law of Moses." Here is justification by faith in Christ with the forgiveness of sins apart from the deeds of the law, with not a word about the Gentile question in the whole synagogue address. The turn to the Gentiles did not begin until a week later, verse 46. The Greek literally says, "You," that is, "you Jews, were not able," that's a Greek aorist, "you were not able in the law of Moses to be justified." Which, if the new perspective redefinition of justification is applied, would mean that the Mosaic law was never a valid identity badge for Jews, which contradicts their premises and would be historically false. These verses, then, are toxic to the new perspective. So what does N.T. Wright have to say in his 1,700-page monograph, Paul and the Faithfulness of God, about this recorded first mention of the cardinal doctrine of justification, said to be, here in this place, quote, "the germ of all that is most characteristic in Paul's later teaching," unquote? What does Wright say about this little difficulty for the new perspective in his magnum opus, the fruits of 40 years Pauline scholarship, that dedicates 656 pages specifically to Paul's theology, cites 533 references from the Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha, 447 references from pagan sources, and 310 from Qumran, Josephus, Philo, and the rabbis? Not a word. Not one word, not even a footnote. Well, Wright did put us on notice that nothing massive can rest on Acts, especially from words put into his mouth, Paul's mouth. So doubtless he came and looked and passed by on the other side. Let us hear once again what Paul said to Jews before turning to the Gentiles. "Through this man is preached unto you the forgiveness of sins, and by him All that believe are justified from all things from which ye could not be justified by the law of Moses. And here is what Paul later wrote to those who were Jews by nature. We have believed in Jesus Christ that we might be justified by the faith of Christ and not by works of the law. For by the works of the law shall no flesh be justified. The parallel is striking. Peter's believing in Christ that he might be justified must have been some 15 years before the Gentile mission. So how could justification by faith be a polemical doctrine invented by Paul to deal with the Gentile problem and divisive boundary markers? Even more telling, how could Paul have preached justification in the synagogue unless the concept was already familiar to the Jewish mind? Daniel Boyarin, the rabbinical Jew, and I'm going to quote him quite a bit. Sometimes he's good to quote, and other times he's for the new perspective. Daniel Boyarin, the rabbinical Jew and Talmudist, informs us that, quote, the term justification itself is not a novum of Christianity, but simply a basic Jewish notion. It refers to the situation of the believer at the Last Judgment, when the question is, will I be acquitted by the divine court? Justification means acquittal. Paul's thought is therefore primarily soteriological. This lays the axe at the root of the tree. From both the word itself and the context, Paul's hearers would have understood justification as a matter of salvation affecting them individually. How did the new perspective develop? Barry Matlock pointed out in 1998 that those associated with the new perspective have wanted not merely to present their new picture of Paul, but also to say just where, how, and why the old picture went wrong. The history, or story, of interpretation is told with a very strong moral, offering a self-consciously hermeneutical lesson. To this we now turn. Prestige New Testament scholarship, dominated by the German Lutherans before the Second World War, shifted in its aftermath to universities in the United States. Lutheran scholarship was increasingly perceived there as anti-Jewish. Typical is Boyarin, who we've mentioned, who complained, quote, to the very great extent that the work of Bultmann and Casaman is generated by anti-Judaism, which is by now, in the late 20th century, no longer distinguishable from anti-Semitism, they represent the continuation of a kind of Christian discourse that can be held partly responsible for Nazi genocide. Strong stuff. James Dunn concurred, but wanted to pin the blame especially on the Protestant doctrine of justification by faith. Quote, most insidious of all, this way of reading Paul's teaching on justification by faith reinforced the impression that Judaism was a degenerate religion. It has been a deeply disquieting feature of Christian apologetic, reinforced by Reformation polemic, that Christianity has tended to understand itself in antithesis to Judaism. Tragically, it reinforced hatred of Judaism, which was to reach its horrific outworking in the Holocaust. If Christianity, particularly Protestantism, is guilty as charged for perceiving Judaism to be degenerate and on certain matters antithetical, it is only fair to see how Judaism perceives Christianity in relation to itself. The renowned Jewish Encyclopedia capably contrasts Paul's soteriology and anthropology with their corresponding doctrines in Judaism, which I now quote from the Jewish Encyclopedia. The Jew will greatly differ from him, that's Paul, with regard to every argument and view of his. He has no faith in the moral power of man. He robs the human soul of its faith in its own regenerating powers and of its belief in its own self and in its inherent tendencies to goodness. His church has by no means the moral perfection of the human race for its aim and end, as has Judaism. It is not personal merit, nor the greater moral effort that secures salvation, but some arbitrary act of divine grace which justifies. It is not righteousness in the Jewish sense which leads to salvation, but faith in the atoning power of Christ's death, which in some mystic or judicial manner justifies the undeserving. Paul argues that the saving grace of God lies in faith, not in the works of the law. And so he declares faith in Jesus' atoning death to be the means of justification and salvation, and not the law. He construed a system of faith which was at its very outset most radically in conflict with the spirit of Judaism and laid the foundation of the world domination of pagan Christianity. Protestantism revived Pauline views and notions, and with these a biased opinion of Judaism and its law. Unquote. There can be no question but that Christianity is portrayed at best as degenerate, and Protestantism Judaism's most pronounced antithesis. The Jewish doctrines portrayed by Jews themselves are also unashamedly Pelagian. That there exist fundamental antitheses between these religions is thus not a perception peculiar to Christianity. Pretending that these differences do not exist or have been invented or exaggerated, and attempting to Judaize Christian doctrine, which is effectively what the New Perspective is doing, requires a denial of essential truths that impinge treacherously on the gospel. In 1961, Christa Stendahl gave his now famous paper entitled The Apostle Paul and the Introspective Conscience of the West, in which he claimed that Luther misunderstood Paul by reading him through his own experience, with problems and categories that would have been foreign to a first century Jew. Says Stendahl, quote, "The West for centuries has wrongly surmised that the biblical writers were grappling with problems which no doubt are ours, but which never entered their consciousnesses." Stendahl considered that Luther's sense of his own sinfulness and need to find a gracious God affected his reading of Paul because Luther silently presupposed that human nature remained essentially the same. But Stendahl doubts that Paul would have had similar concerns. Quote, "How and in what sense was he conscious of actual sins? Does he ever intimate that he is aware of any sins of his own? We look in vain for a statement in which Paul would speak about himself as an actual sinner." Yes, I know, you'll say he's the chief of sinners, I know, but those are in the excluded epistles, so they don't count. Paul didn't write that. Stendahl, yes. Well, if Paul didn't consider himself a sinner, then, says Stendahl, quote, "the famous formula simul justus et peccator cannot be substantiated as the centre of Paul's conscious attitude." Stendahl laid the ground for a reinterpretation of justification by faith from being a soteriological to an ecclesiological Jews and Gentiles issue. He says, "the reformer's interpretation of Paul rests on an analogism when Paul's statements are read in the framework of late medieval piety, where Paul was concerned about the possibility for Gentiles to be included in the Messianic community, his statements are now read as answers to the quest for assurance about man's salvation. Drastic is the reinterpretation once the original framework of Jews and Gentiles is lost and the Western problems of conscience become its unchallenged and self-evident substitute." Stendahl concluded that his insight, quote, "opens up a new perspective for theology," unquote. Indeed, it did. If Stendahl cracked the mould back in 1961, it was E.P. Sanders who finally broke it in 1977. Sanders, who described himself as, quote, "a liberal, modern, secularised Protestant brought up in a church dominated by low Christology and the social gospel," unquote, fell in love, his expression not mine, with the rabbis, and produced his monograph, Paul and Palestinian Judaism, A Comparison of Patterns of Religion. Part one on Palestinian Judaism is regarded by the New Perspective as one of their founding documents. Since it is a main foundation upon which the New Perspective is built, we must deal with it at some length. Sanders' purpose, in his own words, was, quote, "to destroy the view of rabbinic Judaism, which is still prevalent in much, perhaps most, New Testament scholarship, and to establish a different view." We might well wonder what relevance rabbinic Judaism could be to New Testament scholarship, since it did not exist until well after the New Testament was complete. As Boyarin confirms, quote, "I would like to make this absolutely clear," says Boyarin, "we have no direct evidence for such a movement prior to the late 2nd century. Accordingly, when we speak of rabbinic Judaism, we are speaking of a post-Pauline religious development, unquote. Sander's aim was to establish that this post-biblical Judaism was characterized not by works righteousness, but by what he calls covenantal gnomism, whereby one gets into the community by grace and stays in by keeping the law, and where legal perfection is not necessary because various means of atonement are available to deal with transgressions. Sanders then attempted to, quote, argue a case for Palestinian Judaism as a whole, intending to leave the impression that he had demonstrated that the form of religion in Palestinian Judaism before AD 70 was also characterized by covenantal gnomism. Considering that there were dozens of Jewish movements in Palestine in the first century who have left little evidence, this is impossible. Rabbinic Judaism had become the dominant form by AD 500. The rabbis claimed the Pharisees as their antecedents, but this sect, though influential, constituted no more than 1% of the population of Palestine in the mid-first century. Moreover, extant first century Jewish writings such as 4th Ezra, the Apocalypse of Baruch, and 2nd Enoch do teach works righteousness. Sanders, in this book here, frankly admits that, quote, the doctrine of salvation by works is expressed in this extant literature, and that, quote, in 4th Ezra, one sees how Judaism works when it actually does become a religion of individual self-righteousness. All that is left is legalistic perfectionism, unquote. So let's be clear. Works righteousness was alive and well in first century Judaism. But because these texts do not support his thesis, Sanders sets them aside as uncharacteristic of Palestinian Judaism as a whole. But one cannot set aside undesirable evidence and then argue for alternative characteristics applying to religion as a whole. What is more, such works were never regarded as uncharacteristic in the judgment of the Jews themselves. According to the blurb in its published English translation, the Apocalypse of Baruch, which is toxic to Sanders' thesis, quote, presents a vivid picture of the hopes and beliefs of Judaism during the years 50 to 100 CE. And even more devastating, the Jewish Encyclopedia says of the Apocalypse of Baruch that many parallels exist between the Apocalypse and rabbinical literature. The Apocalypse has many points of agreement with the Pharisaic doctrines. It is in almost literal agreement with a Pesicta Rabbati, and the agreement is to be explained on the ground that the old Midrash upon which the Pesicta drew was derived from a time when the Apocalypse was still read by the Jews. So the Jews themselves identify a transmission path from first century Jewish sacred literature, which has doctrine similar to the Pharisees and displays works righteousness, right into the mainstream rabbinical corpus of the 9th century. Unquestionably, Sanders was successful in inserting his own view of rabbinic Judaism into the minds of New Testament scholars, who knew no better, and having them believe that Palestinian Judaism as a whole was characterized by the same form of religion centuries earlier. His views were seized upon by scholars N.T. Wright and James Dunn. Wright declared, quote, until a major refutation of his central thesis is produced, honesty compels us to do business with him. I do not myself believe such a refutation can or will be offered. It can easily be refuted 100 times over. But comments such as this make it all the more difficult to make a persuasive critique of Sanders' work because he has opened up a new paradigm. If one is persistent with Paul and Palestinian Judaism, one will eventually reach page 426 and discover the following astonishing admission. Quote, our study has not been designed to answer the question of what Judaism was like in Palestine before 70 CE. AD 70 is a watershed after which significant changes occurred in Judaism as it had no temple. It would be too much to expect, therefore, that Sanders could have much to say about the Judaism of the days of Christ and his apostles, but Sanders cannot restrain himself. Quote, on the assumption that a religion should be understood on the basis of its own presuppositions, we must say that the Judaism of before 70 kept grace and works in the right perspective, unquote. What is a right perspective? Either Sanders is smuggling in his own personal opinion of what constitutes a right perspective of grace and works. In other words, his own presuppositions are masquerading as a conclusion, or, and more likely, this is a classic example of the self-referential fallacy. Any theology viewed according to its own presuppositions keeps everything in the right perspective, because a right perspective is just another expression for understood on the basis of its own presuppositions. We should add that Sanders' conclusion is begging the question. For until we know what Judaism was like in Palestine before AD 70, which Sanders admits his study was never designed to answer and couldn't answer, it is impossible to state what the presuppositions of Judaism then were, or to form any judgment as to the relationship of faith and works therein. Sanders says, quote, "For Judaism generally, grace and works were not considered as opposed to each other. The notion that God's grace is in any way contradictory to human endeavour is totally foreign to Palestinian Judaism. The reason for this is that grace and works were not considered alternative roads to salvation. Salvation is always by the grace of God." The very same could be said of Romanism. Sanders does nothing here to rescue Judaism from the charge of Pelagianism and synergistic soteriology. A meaningful opposition, and the one that is the Reformation antithesis, would be justification by faith apart from works and justification involving works, since the one logically excludes the other. But neither is in principle opposed to grace. But we can further demonstrate that Sanders' conclusions are not merely unsafe, but vacuous, because he did not define his terms. He makes his clincher in his conclusion, which underpins his whole concept of covenantal nomism, that, quote, "in all the literature surveyed," that's a good expression, isn't it? "In all the literature surveyed, obedience maintains one's position in the covenant, but it does not earn God's grace," unquote. If we assume Sanders is employing Christian terminology, he could have saved himself the trouble of the literature survey, since in no religion will there ever be found grace that is earned or a covenant breached by keeping its terms. But if grace and obedience have indefinite meanings, then Sanders' covenantal nomism is greatly misleading. In truth, Sanders fell in love with the rabbis and crafted an image of Judaism that could be appreciated by liberal Protestants like himself. Jacob Neusner, a celebrated academic scholar of Judaism and translator of almost the whole rabbinic canon, recognized this and described Sanders' work as, quote, "a Protestant theological apologetic for a Judaism in the liberal Protestant model, which was thereby, quote, a kind of anti-Semitism," unquote. "Nor," says Neusner, "do I value a defense of my religion that accepts at face value what another religion values. For in the end, Sanders wants to defend Judaism by his representation in a form that, in his view, Christianity should appreciate today. That approved Judaism turns out to be a Judaism in the model of Christianity, in Sanders' pattern. Judaism represented as kosher to liberal Protestantism is only a caricature and an offence." Accordingly, the new perspective has been misled by Sanders into the most incredible misapprehensions. Thus done, quote, "only with the publication of E.P. Sanders' Paul and Palestinian Judaism has the meaning got through, that Judaism is first and foremost a religion of grace. The Judaism of what Sanders christened as covenantal nomism can now be seen to preach good Protestant doctrine, that grace is always prior. The Council of Trent also affirmed that grace was prior, but they anathematized good Protestant doctrine. Neither do Jews affirm Protestant doctrine. Boyarin, a confessional Jew himself, states the position of his own religion." Listen carefully, please. "There do not seem to have been any Jews who thought that works were sufficient for salvation." That's all well and good. "God's grace is necessary." Okay. "But trying to keep the law is a necessary condition for God's grace to come." Oh dear. "Thus the Jewish answer to such questions as, how can I find a gracious God, or what must I do to be saved, can be none other than keep the law. Far from Luther misrepresenting Judaism, he had a better grasp than Sanders or Dunn, for in his commentary on Galatians, Luther summarised Jewish thinking thus. The Jew thinks to himself, quote, sorry, this is the whole quote. The Jew thinks to himself, if I obey the law of Moses, I shall find God gracious to me, and so I shall be saved. Which is essentially what Bayarin affirms for salvation. Trying to keep the law is a necessary condition for God's grace to come. And Bayarin is no outlier in Jewish soteriology. Stephen Katz, Jewish scholar and director of the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies at Boston University, gives a fuller description in his article Man, Sin and Redemption in Rabbinic Judaism in the very highly regarded Cambridge History of Judaism. Quote, in Rabbinic Judaism, redemption is conceived of as an earned response. Human beings merit redemption through their good deeds. This means that God responds to men after they have responded appropriately to him. Human beings must take the first step. The initiative from below is, for the rabbis, a necessary part. Of course, God in his graciousness acts to a degree greater than required according to a strict measure to transform the situation from one of strict justice to one in which divine compassion gives new transcendental value to human deeds. Again, we see that while salvation is by grace, only works secure it. Those of you familiar with late medieval theology will have spotted that this Jewish soteriology contains analogues of the scholastic concepts of congruent and condign merit, and where God graciously gives meritorious value to works. In his Theological Dictionary of Rabbinic Judaism, Jacob Neusner describes Jewish works of supererogation. Yes, that is the term he uses. Doing more than the strict requirement of the law, and so building up a treasury of merit that can even benefit deceased relatives. So if Sanders has persuaded liberal Protestantism that Judaism preaches good Protestant doctrine, he has achieved a monumental deception. This misapprehension undergirds the whole New Perspective enterprise. Whatever Sanders' questionable methods and dubious conclusions, he de facto smashed all reliance upon the New Testament for any information about first century Judaism and Paul's Jewish background. It was this that emboldened Daniel Bayarin to weigh in with his own take on Paul, a radical Jew, which Wright admired and saluted as an astonishing achievement. Bayarin announced, "This book is part of the movement to thoroughly discredit the Reformation interpretation of Paul." Oh, so at least he's pinning his colours to the mast there. James Dunn accepted that which I have identified as Sanders' unimpeachable achievement. So you see here where Dunn was being influenced by what Bayarin was saying about Sanders. James Dunn accepted that which I have identified as Sanders' unimpeachable achievement, namely the insistence that any descriptions of Judaism from which Paul came and to which he reacted have to be based on Jewish texts and not on Paul himself. "Let me repeat this point," says Bayarin. "Whatever any interpreter ends up saying about Paul and Judaism from now on starts from actual Jewish texts and not from Paul." Yeah. It fell to Wright and Dunn to combine the insights of Sanders and Stendhal and synthesise what was announced in 1982 as the new perspective on Paul. It incorporates misrepresentations of historical theology and feeds off widespread ignorance of the same. As Ligon Duncan has said, "If you don't know what the Reformers said, then you are vulnerable to having someone else tell you what they said and tell you wrong, and you'll have no way of telling the difference." Speaking of the view of the Reformers, Dunn announced as though it were established fact, quote, "The antithesis to justification by faith, what Paul speaks of as justification by works, was understood in terms of a system whereby salvation is earned through the merit of good works. The hermeneutical mistake was made of reading this antithesis back into the New Testament period, of assuming that Paul was protesting in Pharisaical Judaism precisely what Luther protested against in the pre-Reformation church, a system of earning salvation by the merit of good works with little or no room for the free forgiveness and grace of God. It was this depiction of first century Judaism which Sanders showed up for what it was, a gross caricature, which regrettably has played its part in feeding an evil strain of Christian anti-Semitism." So, who is doing the caricaturing? Dunn is misrepresenting both the Reformers and the Roman Catholic Church. To classify that church as teaching a hyper-Pelagian system of earning salvation with no place for forgiveness and grace is itself a gross caricature. Medieval Romanism was full of talk of grace and forgiveness, and has always taught salvation by grace. The problem is its synergism and confusion of grace and works for justification. Whether we look at Peter Lombard, who was broadly Augustinian, Thomas Aquinas, a Dominican, or Bonaventure, a Franciscan, though there are differences, we find a dependence on grace, from preparation to receive grace, to its reception in justification, to perseverance in grace, to works meritorious of eternal life. The voluntarist scholastics, representative of the Via Moderna, such as Gabriel Biel, taught that merit depends not on any intrinsic value in works, but on a covenant in which the works are graciously deemed meritorious. They distinguish between condign merit and congruent merit. The thought was, God will not deny his grace to the one who does what is in him. It is not formally Pelagian, but sails close to it and has many resonances with Judaism. While rightly rejecting these views as unbiblical, the reformers never believed Rome taught a system of earning salvation by the merit of good works apart from grace and forgiveness. Yet the reformers have been portrayed as creating a gross caricature of first century Judaism as a foil for their doctrine of justification by having views imputed to them about Catholicism, Judaism, and Pauline doctrine that they never held, and of a method of reading back and making assumptions that they never employed. The caricature, assumptions, and reading back are all the inventions of the new perspective itself. The following by Sanders is typical. Quote, "Luther, plagued by guilt, understood righteousness to be fictional, ascribed to Christians by mere imputation. Luther's emphasis on fictional imputed righteousness has been influential because it corresponds to the sense of sinfulness which many feel, and which is part and parcel of Western concepts of personhood, with their emphasis on individualism and introspection. At least as far back as 1513, Luther believed in justification by an alien righteousness, but never a fictional one. But neither was Luther plagued by guilt, as Sanders suggests. The conscientia that Luther spoke about in his Latin writings was most emphatically not the conscientia from which modern views of conscience can be traced. As Luther specialist Professor Philip Carey points out, quote, for Luther, conscience is the awareness of standing before God. Thus a troubled conscience is one that does not have assurance of justification. For Luther, when the conscience is aware of sin, it does not have guilt feelings, but rather feels terrified of God's judgment. Luther's conscience projected him coram Deo, before the face of God. His terror was due to extrospection, not the problem of a guilt-ridden Western introspective conscience. Neither was his assurance that of certainty in the later Cartesian sense of perception of ideas in his own mind, but the certainty of faith that God speaks the truth in the gospel. As Carey states it, for Luther, quote, the certainty of faith is rigorously objective rather than subjective, in the sense that what makes faith certain is not the activity of the subject of faith, the perception, reasoning, intuition, or experience of the believer, but the faithfulness of the object of faith, the fact that God keeps his word. The irony, then, is that the new perspective proponents have been projecting onto Luther anachronistic concepts, assuming that their post-Enlightenment ideas were his. An associated myth is that Luther's conscience found peace when he abandoned a Pelagian system of merit through works righteousness and embraced justification by faith alone. Dunn cites Luther's autobiographical account of his struggle with the righteousness of God in Romans 1:17, but that was in 1519, and he had for years repudiated works righteousness and had believed that the Christian's righteousness was alien. Though Luther's doctrine of justification was not fully developed until 1521, Luther taught justification by faith alone apart from works no later than mid-1515. And yet, his conscience was troubled for the next 4 years, though clearly not because he was striving to be justified by works. Luther found relief not when he understood the doctrine of justification by faith alone, but when he took God at his word and believed the gospel. Accordingly, Luther could not have read back this 20th century historical invention onto his understanding of Paul, as Dunn and Sanders claim. The Reformers had such a high view of God and his word and of their utter dependence on him that they would not have been blown about as the new perspective alleges. We must draw to a close. We have seen how the new perspective is motivated by a desire to reformulate the doctrine of justification into a means to promote social change and social action. We have traced how it goes astray because it operates with defective reasoning from unsafe and false presuppositions, misrepresenting the Protestant reformers, Romanism and Judaism along the way. We noted that its first exegetical strike is on justification, from where it all gets worse, desiccating the gospel. It is a malignancy that must needs be cut out of the church. If you have ever felt attracted to the new perspective, I appeal to you to study its proponents' terms and conditions, their presuppositions, before taking delivery of their exegesis. My counsel is nullius in verba magistri. Don't take their word for anything. Verify all premises and statements by an appeal to the facts and ad fontes. There is too much at stake to do otherwise. For as Luther said of the doctrine of justification, we must be sure concerning this doctrine and not doubt, for otherwise all is lost, and the Pope and devil and all things gain victory and suit over us. Thank you.